There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Huh?
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Riesmandel. I am your host on today. Oh, it's all me. Oh, it's the end of August, and Congress is out of session. The FCC not doing too much, but there's still news to be had. And there's a lot of things sitting on the table waiting for action that affect our ability to communicate. So I'm going to give you a rundown of some of these fun stories on today's show. Please, you do want to stay tuned. So here on the Media Geek program, one of the things I try to do on a very regular basis is to bring you news of our media environment. These are stories about lots of different media things, be they media deals, media regulation, media policy, things that come out of Washington, and they may also deal with things like intellectual property rights, and sometimes even deal with things like electronics and computers and the internet. It's all being converged together. And the reason why I cover these stories is because in the mainstream press, they're often covered as if they're business stories, not things that affect our democracy, our ability to function in a democracy, our ability to gain the information we need to make reasonable, informed decisions about what we want our lives and our world to be like. And in fact, when you watch television and you listen to radio news, very often these issues aren't covered at all. And if they aren't covered for just moments, and usually not in a longitudinal fashion, you don't hear follow-up. And so much it's about the bottom line, how does this affect business, not how this affects our own ability to understand the world around us. That's what I try to do here in Media Geek, and I put that in perspective with independent and grassroots media, because I think that these are very important institutions and movements, both here in the U.S. and around the world, that try to let people have an opportunity to speak for themselves, to speak more freely, rather than simply be mediated by or mediated for. And so that's what I try to do, and I try to catch up every so often. Now, right now, it's August, right, as I mentioned at the intro to the show, and things are kind of quiet on the regulatory front in that Congress is out of session. House members are gearing up for those midterm elections. Some Senate senators are gearing up for midterm elections as well. And they left undone a bunch of things having to do with media. One of the biggest things, still not yet completed, is the national franchise. That is the creation of a national contract for providing cable television service. As it is now, cable companies negotiate with individual municipalities in order to provide cable TV services to the households and businesses in a particular area. A bill passed in the House earlier this year called the COPE Act, which would extend this to a national franchise so that the same terms would apply all over the country. And the purpose of this particular bill was really to speed the entry of the largest telephone companies into this market. They don't want to have to go municipality to municipality in order to start offering video services over broadband lines, many of which are new, or they're newly installing. And that did pass the House, but and it has not yet, though, come to the floor of the Senate. And a bill came out of the Senate Commerce Committee, which would create that national franchise. But the one thing that many public interest advocates are looking for in exchange for that national franchise, in exchange for speeding these large companies like AT&T and Verizon into the cable TV arena, the thing they've been looking for in exchange has been guarantees that these companies therefore will not limit their internet traffic of the of their users. So the idea goes that if you're an AT&T and Verizon and you're offering television, cable TV like services over your internet broadband lines to people's televisions, you might see things like YouTube or Google Video or other more grassroots video providers on the internet as a threat to your bottom line, since they might be providing things that people want to watch for free or very low cost compared to your usual cable TV offerings, and might ratchet it down. And this isn't an unsubstantiated fear. It comes out of the fact that the CEO of AT&T, Ed Whitaker, has said as much in public comments that he would like to charge internet companies like a YouTube, like Google, for the bandwidth that they use sending information to users. Except for the fact that, as the internet has been thus far, the users of an internet line, if you have DSL, you actually pay for that bandwidth. And so a lot of people, including Google, a lot of internet companies, but along with public interest advocates, are looking for that to be put into law to say that if you are Verizon or you are AT&T, you cannot put limits on the bandwidth that people get. They get what they pay for, and they don't. You can't basically double dip and charge Google Video or charge YouTube for that bandwidth, because frankly, YouTube, Google, or MediaGeek, I already pay for bandwidth to get to the internet. I pay for the bandwidth that all those podcasts and downloads of the MP3s at my radio.mediageek.net site, I actually pay for that bandwidth every single day. I pay it to my hosting, to my internet provider there, who is in turn paying it to whichever internet service provider they happen to use. The whole point of the internet is you're not supposed to have to pay down the line. Everyone pays for the connection to the internet to have access to the stuff on the internet or to serve it up over the internet. It doesn't get double-dipped. You don't have to pay for it twice down the line. So a particular provision that would have provided network neutrality and put it into law did not pass the Senate House, the Senate Commerce Committee. It failed as a tie. It didn't pass the House either. But we're still sitting in limbo with regard to the national franchise and moving AT&T and Verizon into the cable TV markets across the country in one fell swoop. Part of that is because, at least in the Senate, there's been no guarantee that there's a full 60 votes there, and Senate Democrats have really been holding the line on that particular issue, saying that they were going to either filibuster or place a hold on the national franchise bill. And therefore, Senator Bill Frist, who is the majority leader in the Senate, said he would not bring the national franchise bill to the floor for a vote unless he was sure that he had enough votes, Republican votes, to overturn a hold or overturn that particular filibuster on that issue. So it's out there. And frankly, it looked like a lot of senators, especially those who may be facing re-election fights, pretty tough re-election fights, didn't want to have to go back to their home districts, tarred with the accusation that they had killed network neutrality or they had killed freedom of speech on the internet before the November election. So we may see action on that when Congress comes back together in September. We may not, but it's still hanging out there unresolved. But another federal body may want to get in on the Network Neutrality Act. The Federal Trade Commission now has formed an Internet Access Task Force to examine network neutrality and also to look at whether the fears of large broadband providers blocking or slowing web content from competitors is justified. That's according to the agency's chairwoman, Deborah Platt Majoras, I'm not sure whether that's you pronounce that J or not, who also called on lawmakers to be cautious about passing a network neutrality law, which could prohibit broadband providers such as AT&T and Comcast from giving their own internet content top priority or from charging websites additional fees for faster service. Although the chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission did say that she thought that network neutrality advocates are sincere in their concerns. She said this at a speech at the Progress and Freedom Foundation's Aspen Summit in Colorado. She said, quote, "I just question the starting assumption that government regulation rather than the market itself under existing laws will provide the best solution to a problem," end quote. The Progress and Freedom Foundation is pretty much a free market, very sort of right-wing think tank there. So it sounds as though she's a bit critical, although Public Knowledge, which is a consumer advocacy group, said that they welcomed the Federal Trade Commission's examination of network neutrality. President Gigi Sohn told the press, quote, "We certainly look forward to the analysis of an agency that exists to protect competition of the broadband market in which 98% of customers receive their service from either the telephone company or the cable company, if they have that choice at all." She also went on to say, quote, "There are no market forces at work here, much as Chairman Majors wishes there to be," end quote. So maybe the Federal Trade Commission is going to take a look at network neutrality. Although there, it's hard to tell whether they're going to do so in order to sort of rubber stamp the industry position, or at least the telephone industry position, which is, and those companies have spent quite a lot of money, millions of dollars this year, in fact, trying to paint network neutrality as a defense of a free ride of companies like Google on the backs of the poor broadband companies like Verizon or AT&T. So it looks like this fight is going to heat up probably as we head into September. That is something to sort of to really keep our eyes on. Another thing to keep our eyes on that has a potential for great effect on our traditional media is media ownership. And the FCC has opened up their review of media ownership rules. This is a re-review. They actually rewrote the rules back in 2003. But those were struck down by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. So they have to take another stab at it. And the problem with this particular endeavor is right now, we really haven't heard anything from the FCC about it. On August 17th, the FCC announced that they were opening up the proceeding. And so we all have an opportunity to comment to the FCC about media ownership and the particular rules that are under the microscope, so to speak. One of those rules is the cross-ownership rule. In most places, there's a ban that prevents TV stations and newspapers from being co-owned. There are some grandfathered TV stations and newspapers under this rule, but in most places, including most of the places where Media Geek is heard, that ban is still in place. A TV station and newspaper cannot be co-owned. In 2003, the FCC looked to mostly undo that rule, as well as loosen some of the restrictions between co-ownership of newspapers, television stations, and radio stations. And that's a pretty big deal, since in many cases, in a lot of cities, the only local news that you get comes from maybe one local TV station and one newspaper. If they're allowed to be co-owned, you might lose quite a bit of your news diversity there. And especially you'd lose critical reporting of one on the other, the TV station reporting on the newspaper or vice versa. Pretty big deal. The FCC has promised to release research reports on this particular issue and on various other issues, looking at things such as real effect on markets, looking at media diversity, looking at, you know, whether or not there is a great diversity of news outlets and media in various markets. But we've yet to see those, and yet the comment deadline keeps creeping up. It's in September. The other thing the FCC has promised to do is to hold local fora, to go around the country and hold a half dozen opportunities for members of the public to come and talk directly to the FCC to hear from various experts on media ownership issues and to register their comments. And none of those have been scheduled yet either. And so what it's starting to look like is that many of these opportunities to learn more about the media ownership issues are going to happen after the public has a deadline to submit their comments to the FCC. It's something which I personally feel is a very bad situation. As I sit here waiting for the FCC to tell us what's going on. Some commissioners in the FCC, though, are not taking that particular situation lying down. And so they're going to be attending town meetings and community dialogues on the issue of media ownership. There's one coming up on August 31st in Los Angeles, California, where FCC Commissioners Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps will join elected officials and civic leaders in Los Angeles to listen to local citizens' concerns about localism and diversity. This is a rare opportunity for the public to discuss their issues on media consolidation. That's August 31st, at 6:30 p.m. in Los Angeles. If you want to learn more about that session, go to www.nhmc.org. That's www.nhmc.org. And then a little closer to Media Geek's Central Illinois home, there's going to be a town meeting on the future of media on September 7th at 6:30 p.m. in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. This one sponsored by Free Press. You can find out more about that at freepress.net/future. And once again, there will be Democratic commissioners Jonathan Adelstein and Michael Copps to listen to people's concerns and to talk more about the issue. Notice at both of these two unofficial open fora, you'll see no presence of the other three FCC Republican commissioners who will not be there to listen to people's concerns. They're taking a proactive stance, and in a way, this is starting to mirror what happened with the last FCC rules review, where then-Chairman Michael Powell absolutely refused to have any public fora or to really make any outreach to the public to hear their comments about media ownership, even though the FCC was flooded with comments, in fact, more than they'd ever received before on any proceeding that they'd ever dealt with. And just imagine millions of people getting lit up about media policy. You could see that was a pretty important thing to them. They did eventually hold one session in Richmond, Virginia, not too far away from D.C., but the two Democratic commissioners, Copps and Adelstein, went around the country and held their own unofficial fora to both listen and educate the public. So this is an issue to keep our eyes on this fall. I hope we'll be hearing more from the FCC on it. If you want more information about how you can comment to the FCC and on this particular issue, go to the Media Geek website at MediaGeek.net. You scroll down the right-hand column, and there'll be a link, comment to the FCC. You can also go to StopBigMedia.com, and that's a coalition of different groups who are mobilizing and trying to be active in helping people understand what is at stake with media ownership rules and how they can engage on that particular issue. You are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Reese, and I'm your host, and I'm my own guest today. Only, I'm not going to attempt to do an interview. That would be just a little bit too schizophrenic. But I'm trying to catch up on some of the big issues that are going on right now and sort of preview what's going on in the fall and get caught up on the news. As we are here in the dead of August, where school has begun, both universities and high schools and elementary schools all around the country. I myself work in audio video services for the University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. So I've had a hectic week. School began just a few days ago for me. And luckily last night I had a big opportunity to catch up on all the news, but I do this show alone. It's a one-man operation right now, and I did not have an opportunity to get any other guest. So I hope you find some of this information useful. Much of it does turn up on my website at MediaGeek.net, where I do blog about it. I will put up links to these fora that the FCC will be having and not the FCC, but the FCC commissioners will be having and attending, so that if you want to learn more information about that, you can get to it at MediaGeek.net. And of course, this program can be downloaded at radio.MediaGeek.net. You can also subscribe to the podcast. So I'm going to turn to some news of intellectual property rights, and that's the arcane way of saying it's about what we can do with the media we consume, the media we own, the media we make. Can we copy it? Can we sample it? Can we reuse it? Can we share it? So one thing probably you've heard a lot more about is high-definition television, especially now that people are moving away in droves from your traditional tube TVs. And the flat panel LCD and plasma TVs are picking up market share. And one of the big attractions for those is that most of them are capable of receiving high definition, a higher resolution TV, digital TV broadcasts. And in fact, in 2009, all traditional analog standard definition broadcasts go away. And we will have only, at least over the airwaves, digital high definition broadcasting. A lot of people are preparing now. But yet, we're still, when it comes to movies that we buy, watching standard definition DVDs. And they look good, but high definition DVDs are just now on the horizon. And there's two competing formats, unfortunately. There's HD DVD, and then there's Blu-ray DVD. And HD is a consortium of companies led by Toshiba. And then over on Blu-ray, it's a consortium of companies led by Sony. Have a bit of what you might call an old VHS versus beta debate. One of the advantages of Blu-ray is that it holds more data per disc, but it doesn't seem to have moved as fast in the market as the HD DVDs. Both can be used for data storage, and you can get an HD DVD recorder now, although you cannot get a Blu-ray recorder now, though I guess one has just come out, a Pioneer model, which is $1,000, so you can see what that's like. All this is cutting edge, so it's supposed to offer better video quality, more options, but there's a lot of problems too. Because one of the Hollywood's biggest fears is that people are going to bootleg this stuff and put it up on the internet, put it up on file sharing sites, on BitTorrent sites. And so they're building in digital rights management, also known as DRM. And a little announcement kind of hit the tech world with a pretty big shock on August 24th when senior program manager at Microsoft, Steve Riley, announced at the Tech Ed Australia conference that full high-definition content will only be able to be played on their upcoming Vista software, the new version of Windows, when signed drivers are used. What that means, in more plain English, is that any next-generation high-definition content will not play on existing versions of Windows, on 32-bit versions of Windows at all. And this is a decision that they had to make, the media player folks made at Microsoft, because there are too many ways for there to be holes for people to duplicate this stuff. What this means in reality is that your current version of Windows are not going to play high-definition DVDs, even if you buy them and put them in your computer. So we get this whole area, people gotten very used to using DVDs in their computer, but on the next version of Windows, Vista, if you're using 32-bit applications, which means applications with a lot of existing microprocessors, you will not be able to play it. And in fact, the Windows Media Player won't be able to play any commercial high-def films when Vista ships. It's supposed to ship next year. It's a new version of Windows. You'll have to get software from vendors like CyberLink and InterVideo, and that's provided they can do it. So already there's a bunch of glitches with regard to being able to play these new high-definition video formats in your computers. Other issues with these high-definition video formats is that what Hollywood is pushing for is that unless you have what is called an HDMI connection between your DVD player and your television, you won't actually be able to watch them in high def. The video will be scaled down to standard def, so you won't even get what you pay for, because they're worried about what's called a so-called analog hole. So if you have a lot of people between their televisions and DVD players have what's called component cables, which looks like RCA cables, only it's three cables, and they pass all the video information, usually be colored red, green, and blue. And what the movie studios are hoping to push for is that if you connect your DVD player and your TV together via that, because it's analog, because it's possibly could be copied or could be captured by another device, you will not be able to get high-definition video through it. It's only when using a pure digital connection, which would respect digital rights management, that you could watch this high-def stuff, even if you go out of your way to buy a high-def player and a high-definition discs. So that's a bit of what the effects of digital rights management, and also looking at another issue. So it's slightly arcane, and I covered it on the Media Geek website on the 17th of August. Is that there's this company Macrovision, which is best known for making a copy protection software or scheme for that's been around since the VHS days, and it's a way to keep people from copying VHS tapes. It's also built in all your DVD players, and is one of the reasons why when you try to copy DVDs to a VHS tape, the copies turn out crappy. What it is actually is it inserts a distortion into the video signal that takes advantage of what's called the auto gain circuit inside the VCR that tries to keep the signal at a constant level so you get a good recording. It messes with that so that the picture you get in your resulting VHS tape is going to go from light to dark, is going to kind of pulse. And all DVD players are required by the DVD standard to have that circuit built into them. A DVD tells the circuit to turn on, and most commercial DVDs do that, making it difficult to copy to another VHS tape. If you have a DVD recorder, that's like a standalone deck, that looks like a VCR, only records DVD, those are made to detect that Macrovision signal, and so won't record. So if you plug your DVD player into your DVD recorder, you can't make a copy. But there are lots of little devices made out there that are so-called enhancers or digitizers, which repair that part of the signal damaged by Macrovision to allow you to make these copies, which in many cases is perfectly legal to do. You have what's called fair use rights to make personal copies or possibly to make clips, to take clips of movies and recompile them. This is done a lot of the time in university and educational environments where film professors or other types of instructors will take clips of different films or different TV shows and put them together for easy access in class. And you can use one of these little devices. The biggest company makes them. It's called CIMA, S-I-M-A. And that helps correct the signal and make it so that you can copy. Now, you can only do this through the analog stage, so it's not the same as ripping a DVD into your computer. It's so you go through the analog stage of your DVD player into a VCR, into a DVD recorder or something like that. So it's not really the highest quality way to do it. You do lose some small bit of quality, but it's better than nothing, right? Macrovision has decided to sue CIMA and initially got a preliminary injunction against the company back in June to quit selling these devices, these copy enhancers. It has now been bumped up to the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, so that injunction is in limbo. And Macrovision is claiming that they're using this, that this particular device violates the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And it's because the Digital Millennium Copyright Act in many ways is so vaguely worded that it's unclear whether or not this device is a violation. And the Digital Millennium Copyright Act says that actually a lot of software that rips DVDs is illegal under that Copyright Act. It's illegal to interfere with a digital protection device. And that is intended to stop copying. Even if you have a right to copy otherwise, it's illegal to break a copy protection for the sake of copying, even if you have that right. What's interesting is that a lot of organizations, including the Consumer Electronics Association and the American Library Association, are lining up with CIMA to defend their right to make these products. And I think that their defense is very interesting because what they're saying is that Macrovision copy protection is not actually a copy protection in that it doesn't stop you from making a copy, that you can make that DVD to VHS copy. It'll work, it just won't look very good. So what they're saying that all CIMA does is make you get a good copy instead of a crappy copy. I think it's a very interesting argument. But it's yet another instance where we can see that there could be this wide-ranging effect on our ability to simply use the media we want to use. And as someone who works in educational media, I work with faculty all the time who are trying to create these clip tapes or want to use particular clips in a conference presentation about a film, about television shows, about culture. And to have to try and queue up a videotape every time you want to do it, or to try and find the particular scene on a DVD if there's no bookmark, can often be very difficult, having the ability just to copy a few minutes over, which is otherwise perfectly legal under fair use and under the Teach Act, is very, very great, but technology often gets in the way of that. So that's something interesting going on there. I'll be keeping up with that, both here on the radio show and on the Media Geek blog at MediaGeek.net. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'm your host and producer, Paul Riesmandel, and I'll be back in 1 week with more news about grassroots and independent media, as well as our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at MediaGeek.net, where you'll find the Media Geek blog with frequently updated news and views about our media. You can also download the program at radio.mediageek.net or subscribe to the podcast to have it automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. That's all at mediageek.net. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Lowow. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some segments are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. And Media Geek is heard on 9 other community stations around North America, including KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KQRP in Salida, California, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, WTND in Macomb, Illinois, WRFA in Jamestown, New York, WYQZ in Warrenton-Bealeton, Virginia, CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and Free Radio Olympia in Olympia, Washington. Media Geek is free to air on your local community radio station, too. Just drop me a line at paul@mediageek.org. That email address is also good for any comments you want to send in about the program. Once again, that's paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.